Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mary Shelley, A Very Short Introduction by Charlotte Gordon, narrated by Susie Alphons. Publisher's Note: This audiobook will refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Chapter 1. Legacies. Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein. This is all that most people know about Mary Shelley. If they know anything else, they might also know her as the 16-year-old girl who ran away with poet Percy Shelley. But Mary Shelley was far more than a one-book author, and far more than the young woman who loved Percy. She outlived Percy by almost 30 years, publishing 8 more books after Frankenstein and more than 50 short stories and essays. She wrote biographical sketches and introduced Percy's work to the reading public, editing and compiling his poetry and prose. The mystery is why most people only know her for the first book she wrote, particularly as it was published when she was only 19 years old. Taken as a whole, her work represents a remarkable commitment to social reform and women's independence. Stylistically, she broke conventions and stretched 19th-century literary genres to accommodate the themes and ideas she wanted to express. She published novels set in her own time, historical novels, and a dystopian futuristic novel that is eerily predictive of the calamities that we face today. Her stories and essays were experimental, insightful, and fascinating. Her life, too, was remarkable for its creativity and courage. She set her own rules, supporting herself and her family and friends with her writing for most of her adult life. She broke with convention by bearing children out of wedlock. She traveled throughout Europe and lived as an independent woman during a time when middle-class women were supposed to be wives and mothers, not famous authors. But neglect and misunderstanding are an essential part of the Mary Shelley story. Her reputation suffered after her death, for political reasons, but also because of the history of women and women writers. For over a century, she was overshadowed by her famous husband. Only recently have her complete works been deemed worthy of study. She has been the subject of many biographies, but unfortunately, some of these perpetuated the falsehoods surrounding her life story, as her enemies did their best to destroy her reputation, and her loved ones tried to conceal the truths they considered too scandalous for public consumption. Any study of Mary Shelley must address the dilemma of how much her life should be included in a study of her literary achievements. There is no easy answer to this dilemma, but neither is it an either-or construction. Although it is important to read Mary Shelley's works as standalone texts, her literary and personal choices did not happen in the abstract. She based many of her decisions on the ideas of her parents, the authors Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin. As she grew older, her relationship with Percy would also shape her life as a woman and a writer. Mary Shelley's life was a creative enterprise. She inscribed her choices in time, the way she inscribed words in her notebook. Accordingly, in this book, her biography and her literary texts will be studied side by side in order to reveal how her life informs her work. In addition, she will be referred to as Mary Shelley throughout, even though she was born Mary Godwin. This is to rectify the past practice of referring to her husband as Shelley and Mary by her first name, a diminishment of her status as an author. Legacy. Mary Shelley's birthday, 30 August 1797, marks both a beginning and an end, the start of one life and the close of another. Figure 1. When she was born, she was so weak that it seemed likely she would die within a few days. Her mother, the political philosopher Mary Wollstonecraft, author of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, who had already given birth to a sturdy little girl 3 years earlier, reassured her husband, William Godwin, that the infant would thrive, and devoted herself to strengthening the child, delighting in her new daughter. Unfortunately, Tragedy struck a few days later. Wollstonecraft began to shake and sweat with childbed fever. Her daughter was taken from her arms, and Wollstonecraft died 11 days after giving birth. A shocking loss for the world, but most of all, for the little girl who would never have a mother. Wollstonecraft's death played a decisive role in Mary Shelley's life and in her development as a writer. Haunted by the thought of the mother she never knew, she dedicated herself to upholding Wollstonecraft's progressive principles, devoting much of her work to advocating for women and social reform, using changing literary strategies. In Frankenstein, she depicted a dystopian world where the female characters are unable to counter Victor Frankenstein's ambitions and the results are catastrophic. In her seventh and final novel, Faulkner, the female characters are wise, capable, and effective. They persuade the male characters to abandon their destructive impulses and create a utopian society of domestic tranquility. In her nonfiction, she also argued on behalf of women. In the biographical articles on prominent male authors that she wrote for Dionysius Lardner's Cabinet Cyclopedia, an encyclopedia organized into 9 cabinets or areas, instead of the alphabetical organization of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, which appeared between 1829 and 1846, she made sure to include the women in the men's lives, depicting their wives, sisters, daughters, mothers, and lovers. In her short fiction, she also emphasized the importance of women, depicting the dangers of male tyranny and female passivity. In her travelogues, she asserted her right as a woman author to have her own opinions on politics, art, education, and history. In all of her work, she made her point clear. If women were allowed greater independence, if they had more power in the world, there would be less violence, greater equity, and less injustice. Improving the rights of women would improve the world. Social reform was essential for all of humanity. She applied these principles to her own life, asserting her right to independence by flouting the conventions that restricted the behavior of young women. She also helped women friends escape oppressive marriages and gave what money she could to women who needed financial support. And yet, despite her radical ideas and rule-breaking behavior, despite her lifelong commitment to advancing Wollstonecraft's causes, the rights of women, social justice, and educational and political reform, for more than a century after her death, scholars described her as fearful, conservative, and even a hypocrite. In part, this was because her daughter-in-law, Jane Shelley, tried to make Mary Shelley acceptable to the conservative Victorian public by hiding her mother-in-law's scandal-ridden past, burning her letters, and ripping pages from her diaries. Obituary writers followed suit, painting Mary Shelley as an ideal Victorian wife and minimizing her literary achievements. It is not as the authoress even of Frankenstein that she derives her most enduring and endearing title to our affection, read Mary Shelley's death notice in the Literary Gazette, but as the faithful and devoted wife of Percy Bysshe Shelley. The absurdity of this appraisal would not have been lost on Mary Shelley, who, 37 years earlier, had been castigated for running away with Percy and bearing children out of wedlock. To Mary Shelley, what would have caused true pain was the faint praise for her literary work, particularly the failure to mention the 5 other novels she had published after Frankenstein, her short stories, travelogues, essays, and her many articles. But for the Victorian reading public, a woman could earn no higher praise than being termed a good wife, the erasure of Mary Shelley's literary contributions, and the elevation of her role as a wife represented a triumph for her daughter-in-law. Her enemies leaped upon this mischaracterization, and the consequences were severe, as Mary Shelley's stature as a bold, innovative writer was almost lost to history. Critical appraisal of Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley may not have realized the extent to which she contributed to her own problematic reputation. After Percy's premature death at the age of 29, she devoted herself to building his fame as a poet, painting herself out of the picture, making no mention of the significant role she played in editing his papers, which he had left in such profound disarray that she had to reconstitute poems he had scrawled on different scraps of paper, or on the backs of letters or stories, a Herculean effort. In her biographical notes, she depicted him as a selfless artist, a martyr for the cause of literature, and described herself as an admiring acolyte, leaving out any discussion of their shared reading, her role as a commentator of his work, and her own work as a writer. She was also silent about his atheism and only hinted at his political activism, both of which would have shocked Victorian readers and antagonized Percy's conservative father, who could block the publication of Percy's poetry whenever he wanted. As she explained to the reader in her preface to Percy's collected works, what mattered was Percy's poetry and the poet's exalted nature. Later, in less conservative times, she implied, the whole truth could be told. Her efforts worked, but with unforeseen consequences. Not only had she created a literary character named Percy Shelley, an angelic, otherworldly poet, who bore little resemblance to the actual Percy she had lived with for years, she had also created another character, Mary Shelley, a selfless and devoted wife. As Percy Shelley's fame grew, so did Mary Shelley's, with the result that she became known primarily as Percy's wife, rather than an author in her own right, even though, in 1830, she was named the most distinguished woman writer of the era by the notable literary magazine, The Athenaeum. When she died, her friends and enemies fought over who she had really been. Her daughter-in-law's efforts to make her more palatable to the prim Victorian audience exacerbated the problem. Edward Trelawney, an adventurer and writer, who had known Percy for less than a year, downplayed the importance of Mary Shelley in order to cast himself as the central character in Percy's life. In Trelawney's version of events, he was the only person worthy of writing Percy's life, as Mary Shelley was a hypocrite, a prig, and unworthy of Percy's love. Unfortunately, many literary critics of the 20th century followed Trelawney's lead, accepting his memoir as truth, and discounting Mary's own radical principles, her innovations as a writer, and her commitment to social change. There were exceptions, of course. In 1951, in a groundbreaking biography, Muriel Spark reappraised Mary Shelley, drawing attention to her sophistication as a novelist and her rebellious nature. But Sparks was a lone voice. Even in the 1970s, when there was a new interest in the work of historical women, many scholars continued to echo Trelawney's falsehoods. In 1974, Richard Holmes, Percy Shelley's biographer, made the unfortunate claim that Mary was a lesser literary light and an unworthy wife to Percy, a stance for which he has since apologized. The scholar Betty T. Bennett wrote that when she published the first volume of Mary Shelley's letters in 1980, one reviewer suggested that Mary Shelley's letters were not worth publishing. Those critics who did pay attention to Shelley's literary achievements tended to focus exclusively on Frankenstein, at the expense of her other writing. Feminist scholars of the 1970s and 1980s interpreted her work as growing more conservative over time, expressing their disappointment in what they regarded as a retreat from the public sphere. Over the last 30 years, the critical tide has turned. Undeterred by the historical dismissal of Mary Shelley, recent biographers and literary scholars have devoted their careers to analyzing her writing, revealing the innovations of her lesser-known novels, her short stories, her travel writing, and her biographical essays. Biographers have combed through archives, discovering new documents that illuminate Mary Shelley's self-discipline as a professional writer, Her originality as a novelist, her devotion to radical causes, and her seriousness as a political thinker. As a result, Mary Shelley's importance as a writer and as an advocate for social reform is now well established. Conferences are devoted to the study of her work and her life. And yet, hers is a cautionary tale, for the true Mary Shelley almost vanished from the records, despite the fact that her principles were always there for everyone to see. In her work, she repeatedly announced her allegiance to her mother's philosophy by emphasizing the importance of female friendship, women's independence, the primacy of education, and the dangerous consequences of unchecked male ambition. Her dedication to exploring and prioritizing women's experience led her to overturn literary conventions, expanding the parameters of the historical and gothic novel, and experimenting with literary strategies and style. Recent biographers have shown that she used what power she had to fight for women's independence, helping her friends escape abusive fathers and husbands, and giving money to women in need. In the privacy of her journal, she wrote, "I have ever defended women when oppressed." At no point did she seek to hide her dedication to her mother's ideals. Indeed, she emphasized the role her mother played in her life, frequently expressing her admiration. In a letter to her friend, Frances Wright, she wrote, "The memory of my mother has always been the pride and delight of my life, and the admiration of others for her has been the cause of most of the happiness I have enjoyed. Her greatness of soul has perpetually reminded me that I ought to degenerate as little as I could from those from whom I derived my being." In 1831, in a preface for a new edition of her father's novel, Caleb Williams, she declared, "The writings of this celebrated woman are monuments of her moral and intellectual superiority. Her lofty spirit, her eager assertion of the claims of her sex, animate the vindication of the rights of woman. Her unwearied exertions for the benefit of others, her rectitude, her independence, joined to a warm, affectionate heart, and the most refined softness of manners, made her the idol of all who knew her." And yet, despite Mary Shelley's public statements, despite the breadth and depth of her literary innovations, and her advocacy for women's independence in her fiction, until recently, most readers did not grasp the extent of Wollstonecraft's impact on her daughter, an oversight which stems from, and has contributed to, the misunderstanding of Mary Shelley's life and work. Those critics who saw Mary Shelley as a conservative, or worse, as a hypocrite, depicted mother and daughter as opposites, painting Wollstonecraft as a social reformer, and Mary Shelley as a compromiser. This depiction of Mary Shelley was compounded by the different literary strategies deployed by mother and daughter. Mary Shelley expressed many of her most radical ideas through the voices and actions of fictional characters, while Wollstonecraft explicitly outlined her beliefs in her essays. Even in her novels, Wollstonecraft's style was emphatic and argumentative, ensuring that readers understood her points, whereas Mary Shelley's fiction was multifaceted, containing competing points of view. Biographers also played a role, with many assuming that Wollstonecraft had a limited influence on her daughter's work, since she died immediately after her birth. They also point to the fact that Wollstonecraft lived during more radical times. Aged 16, when the American Revolution broke out, Wollstonecraft lived and worked during the progressive era of the Enlightenment and helped promote the early ideals of Romanticism. Mary Shelley, on the other hand, began her life during the Romantic era, but ended her years in the repressive atmosphere of the mid-19th century. But understanding Wollstonecraft's legacy is the key to understanding her daughter, as, over the course of her long writing career, Mary Shelley strove to live up to her mother's radical philosophy and dedicated her life to fulfilling her mother's dreams. Far from becoming more conservative as a writer, She grew increasingly radical, exposing the harm done by allowing men too much power and women too little. In her final novels, the female characters are strong enough to create what the critic Anne Meller calls the egalitarian bourgeois family, and another describes as utopian domesticity, triumphing over the traditional male values of war, honor, and individual ambition. Mary Wollstonecraft, famous today for advocating for the rights of women in her Vindication of the Rights of Woman, Mary Wollstonecraft also published A Vindication of the Rights of Men, a fiery attack on tyranny in all its various forms, legal, economic, social, religious, and political. An outspoken advocate for change, Mary Wollstonecraft, figure 2, denounced the unfair laws and prejudices that oppressed all human beings. She supported the French and Haitian revolutions of the late 18th century, the anti-slavery movement, and social reform. In all of her work, she argued on behalf of what she termed the rights of humanity, fighting against the exploitation of working class people, children, women, Native Americans, and enslaved people. Hated by her enemies and revered by her supporters, Wollstonecraft believed that educational reform was the best way for individuals to gain greater liberty. All people were entitled to direct their own lives, including women, she argued, an idea foreign to those experts who preach that females were incapable of thinking for themselves. If women had too much freedom, these experts held, they would disrupt the natural order of society. Women were weaker than men, had smaller brains, and were easily misled. They should be kept safely at home, where they could be protected by the men in their lives, upper and middle class women, that is. Few people thought about protecting working class women, who were routinely subjected to abuse and violence, a situation that outraged Wollstonecraft, and which she addressed in her final, unfinished novel, Maria, or The Wrongs of Woman. In this work of fiction, Jemima, a maid, details the rape and abuse she undergoes at the hands of her employer. Wollstonecraft has Jemima tell her story in her own voice, one of the first times that a working-class woman is put center stage in English fiction. Jemima tells her story to a young, middle-class wife, Maria, who outlines her own sad story of abuse. She has been thrown into an asylum by her tyrannical husband, who has seized their child as his lawful property. "Is not the world a vast prison?" Maria asks, "and women born slaves?" By giving equal weight to the voices of both women, Wollstonecraft underlined the point that all women were vulnerable to abuse. Working class and poor women were subject to the abuse of their employers, but wealth was no protection. Middle class women were sold by their fathers to husbands they did not love in exchange for financial settlements. Once they were married, they had to surrender their rights to their husbands. In the English system of coverture, husbands assumed control of their wives' legal, economic, religious, and political identities. Accordingly, wives could not own property, vote, represent themselves in the legal system, or even attend the church of their choice. Children were considered the property of their fathers. Wives did not gain the right to own property until 1870, with the passage of the Married Woman's Property Act, and could not vote until 1928. To most 18th-century English people, women's rights seemed as absurd as the rights of animals. In fact, animals would gain legal protection before women. In 1824, 20 years before the first law was passed that limited, but did not prohibit, violence against women, a law was passed that prohibited the abuse of animals. Wollstonecraft did not hide the fact that she wanted to overturn this system. She wanted women to be able to live independent lives, not just for their own sakes, but for the sake of all humanity. In A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, she argued that men's lives would improve if women were allowed their freedom. But this was sacrilege to conservatives, who declared her a threat to society. They believed that if young women read her work, they would be corrupted by her philosophy, and launched a public vendetta against her, led by Horace Walpole, who called her a hyena in petticoats and a whore. So successful was their campaign that if you looked up prostitution in the index of the influential newspaper, the Anti-Jacobin Review, it said, "See Mary Wollstonecraft." But despite these attacks, Wollstonecraft continued to argue for justice, publishing her ideas in books and articles, translations and reviews, one of the first English women to earn her living as a writer. Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin. Wollstonecraft's commitment to radical principles was supported by her husband, the author William Godwin, another prominent advocate for social reform. United in their belief that every human being was entitled to freedom, Wollstonecraft and Godwin formed a powerful union, joining forces to fight for change. In his monumental work, An Inquiry Concerning Political Justice and Its Influence on General Virtue and Happiness, Godwin declared that all governments, not only unjust ones, infringed the natural rights of the individual. Known today as the father of anarchy, he argued that human beings should be allowed to govern themselves and that governments restricted the liberty of their citizens. He argued that it was reason, and reason alone, that could save human beings from themselves, a moderate stance that was lost on most of his readers. To them, the sheer shock value of political justice transformed Godwin into an icon of revolution. Radicals of all stripes celebrated him as their hero, including, 20 years later, the young poet Percy Shelley. Although Godwin and Wollstonecraft loved one another, they resisted getting married. Both believed that marriage was an institution that debased women. And they were right. Not only did the law of coverture restrict the rights of wives, it was against the law for any woman to escape from an abusive father, husband, or brother. No wife could initiate divorce. Men were held responsible for their wives' behavior and were encouraged to discipline them if they became unruly. If a husband failed to enforce his will, allowing his wife to get out of hand, he was publicly shunned, his masculinity called into question. He could even face legal challenges. Those few women who did try to flee a cruel husband were considered outlaws, since a man had the legal right to pursue his wife and imprison her or commit her to an institution, as Wollstonecraft had depicted in Maria. For almost a year, they conducted their affair in secret. But in 1797, when Wollstonecraft discovered she was pregnant, they faced a dilemma. Women who bore children out of wedlock were punished with social exile, as were their children. Wollstonecraft had already faced this situation. During the French Revolution, she had moved to Paris to report on the dramatic events unfolding there and fallen in love with an American, Gilbert Imlay. Smitten by his apparent embrace of her political philosophy, as well as his open American manners, she believed their relationship was based on trust, loyalty, and equality. When she became pregnant, she assumed that they would make a life together according to these egalitarian principles. But a few months after the birth of her daughter, Fanny, Imlay abandoned her. Disillusioned and despairing, she realized that she was on her own. To earn a living, she would have to pretend to be married, or she and Fanny would face ostracism, and she would not be able to publish her books and articles. An unmarried mother might be acceptable in revolutionary France, but never in England, where her publisher was based. In 1797, she and Godwin confronted the same dilemma, further complicated by the existence of Fanny. If they married, they would reveal to the world that Wollstonecraft and Imlay had not been married, and that Fanny was illegitimate. On the other hand, if they did not marry, their new baby would be stigmatized. Either way, Wollstonecraft's reputation was ruined, and so was that of one child. And so, after much debate, they decided that 3-year-old Fanny would pay the price for the sake of their unborn baby, a truth that would shadow young Mary Shelley for the rest of her life. Although they had succumbed to convention, Godwin and Wollstonecraft resisted the restraints of a typical 18th-century marriage. Wollstonecraft refused to become an ordinary wife. In a letter to Godwin, she declared, "My time appears to me as valuable as that of other persons accustomed to employ themselves." She complained if he left her in charge of dealing with the landlord, the plumbing, or the disagreeable business of settling with tradespeople. In response, Godwin tried to shoulder some of the household responsibilities so that Wollstonecraft could write, an extraordinary concession for the time. In return, she agreed to contribute her earnings to the family's upkeep, another innovation in an era when middle-class men were supposed to be the sole providers for their families. Trailblazers that they were, they knew of no other couples who had made such an arrangement. 130 years later, Virginia Woolf would look to their marriage for inspiration when she was trying to carve out her relationship with her husband, Leonard. To Woolf, Wollstonecraft's marriage would become her most revolutionary act, her most fruitful experiment. The role of the father. After Wollstonecraft died, Godwin was suddenly placed in the role of being the sole parent to both Mary and Fanny, whom he had adopted earlier that year. Although he loved both girls, particularly his own daughter, Godwin, the great advocate for liberty, could be severe, even tyrannical. For all of his public celebration of the rights of the individual, he was rule-bound and adhered to the same schedule every day, no matter what needs the girls might have. He did not allow his daughters to interrupt his writing time, making it clear that his work needed to be prioritized above all else. He was proud of Mary Shelley's intelligence, allowing her to read widely in his library, introducing her to many of his famous friends, including the American exile, Aaron Burr, and encouraging her to write essays and stories, but he was also her severest critic. Over the course of her writing life, she sent him her manuscripts for comments and advice. A ruthless editor, he prevented her from publishing her second novel, Matilda, and did not hesitate to tell her the weaknesses of her work. He also felt free to intervene in her personal life. When she was grief-stricken, after the death of one of her children, he wrote her a severe letter, telling her to cheer up, or Percy would leave her. Given the importance of her father in her own life, it should come as no surprise that Mary Shelley addressed the role of fathers in her written work. She paired this exploration with her advocacy for the rights of women, depicting the harm perpetrated by abusive fathers on daughters, especially when their mothers are absent, dead, or weak. She also focused on the problems caused by neglectful, foolish, or absent fathers. All of her fictional fathers were flawed, and a few were downright terrifying. Later, Mary Shelley would say that though her father loved her, he was rarely affectionate and always distant. In one of her fictional portraits of a father and daughter based on her own relationship with Godwin, she wrote, "My father never caressed me. If ever he stroked my head or drew me on his knee, I felt a mingled alarm and delight, difficult to describe. Yet, strange to say, my father loved me, almost to idolatry. And I knew this, and repaid his affection with enthusiastic fondness, notwithstanding his reserve and my awe." For all of his problems as a parent, Godwin did ensure that his daughter inherited the brilliant legacy of her mother. Reminders of Wollstonecraft were everywhere, from the portrait that hung in Godwin's study to the books that lined the shelves. There was even a handwritten storybook that Wollstonecraft had composed for her older daughter, Fanny. Godwin also made sure to tell both girls stories about Wollstonecraft, and he taught young Mary to read by tracing the letters on her mother's gravestone. Figure 3. As she grew older, Mary Shelley read and reread all of her mother's books, as well as her father's memoir of Wollstonecraft, a biography of his dead wife that he wrote immediately after she died. Godwin's memoir contained many factual errors and shocked contemporary readers with its frank depiction of her sexual life, including her love affair with Imlay and Fanny's birth out of wedlock. It also repeated rumors about sexual affairs that have never been substantiated. But for Mary Shelley, the memoir was a beacon of light, a path out of the stuffy world of 19th-century London. Steeped in her mother's ideas from such an early age, her determination to emulate Wollstonecraft was foundational to her development. She hoped, like an acolyte, to carry forward her mother's spirit, finding inspiration in Wollstonecraft's belief that if society allowed women to achieve independence, the lives of all people would improve.